Hi, this is Chris, and I'm here with the Algonquin Politics Podcast, and today we're going to be talking about how many candidates is too many. This podcast is containing Phil, Apple, Robert, Mr. Barry, and Mr. Kellett, so let's start it off.
Thanks for that introduction, Chris. I'm really excited to talk about this topic today because, as many of you know, I teach government and politics, and the process of selecting a candidate for the general election for each of the parties, it seems to be changing, and it seems to be changing quite rapidly. We've got a lot of candidates in the Democratic race. Anybody know off the top of their head how many?
21, 23.
It really depends on who you count as a candidate, right? And we're just going to throw out there right off the bat, is it a good thing or a bad thing for a political party to have a large number of candidates in a race for the nomination? I'm just going to throw it out there. We're going to get the conversation started right away. What do you all think?
Well, quite frankly, I think it's a bad thing because, there's a principle where you add more options and you kind of disconnect people from these options, right? Like, it's almost like as I think Politico.com described it as being in a cereal aisle. Like, yeah. You have so many choices, you don't know which one to pick, and it causes a kind of like confusion with the voters, and they really don't know which option is the best.
Well, I think it also comes, if you look at the 2016 campaign, Republicans started off with 20 candidates.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of those candidates took away from each other. And since Donald Trump was able to be the loudest and most recognizable of those candidates in the beginning, he took a lot of votes, while the others kind of like a lot of people might have thought others were similar, so their votes would be taken away by people who kind of vote for like the same policies.
Yeah, there was one article that talked about choice overload and how, you know, it's very easy to become overwhelmed with all these people, and it comes less down to the facts and more down to, oh, I know, you know, Joe Biden. I know him. I've heard of him. He was the vice president. I think he would make a great president. It's just so easy to become biased just because of what you first know and what you're familiar with.
Does it take away from the quality of the debate, the discussion, you know, when the space is occupied by so many different voices? It seems to be that's what I'm hearing you say. Mr. Barry, you're leaning in like you're ready to say something. I think we're ready to listen.
Well, that was the point that one of the shared articles that we did in preparation for the podcast talked about. You know, there's so many candidates out there, and you might be – this is the problem that Senator Warren is having. You know, she is the one that came out of the gate saying, I have a program for this, and I have a program for that, and she was more than happy to spell it out to people. And she started getting pushback from people in the Democratic Party telling her that that's just not the way to go about it. And they're saying, listen, if you have a policy program, put it on your website, but simplify, simplify, simplify. You have to be able to, at the end of the day, be the person who rises above 21, 22, 23 other candidates. And it's not because people are going to memorize your specifics. It's going to be how you make them feel. And this whole thing will come down to who can better simplify things. And ultimately, that might not be the best thing for the electorate.
What do you think, Apple? I think that there seems to be a consensus around the table so far that this is kind of a phenomenon that's lowering the quality of the discussion. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think everyone has really good points when they say that it's a very large pool to choose from. However, I think in the beginning, when people are announcing their candidacy, it raises a lot of awareness for the election, and it may prompt more people to get involved. So that's good for democracy. But after a while, it does get complicated because there are so many options. And we all know by the end of this that we're going to have one or two candidates who have the treasure chest, who have the money to actually be able to run a good election, because elections cost so much money nowadays. Like, it's within, what, $50 million? Is that how much Hillary Clinton spent last year?
A lot more than that.
A lot higher than that. We're talking about, I think Hillary Clinton spent upwards of $500 million.
Yeah,
you're hearing numbers out there that are around $800 million.
That's a lot
right.
of money.
This is a good opportunity for us to pivot a little bit to this conversation, to how these candidates are going to start to differentiate themselves on perhaps a debate stage. A lot of us associate a political campaign with debates, and I think it's important to look at early on in this process, when we're now 23 different Democratic candidates, how they're actually going to qualify for the debate stage. And you brought up, Apple, money, right? And here's the way the Democrats for 2020 have decided you're going to earn a place on the debate stage. They've said that one of two things can happen. First of all, if you have 1% in three different polls that the Democratic Party, 1% support, the Democratic Party approves of, then you're good to go. You get on the debate stage. But they have another method. They say that if you have 65,000 unique campaign donors with at least 200 donors in 20 different states, then you qualify to be on the debate stage. So basically they're saying if you have earned money from a lot of different places for your campaign, you get to be a part of the conversation. Do you think that's a good way of doing it? I'm going to open it up to the field there.
I think that kind of disagrees with a lot of opinion where a lot of politicians kind of say, like, we don't want, like, lobbyists or people, like, in the pockets of big investors or donors, where that's kind of contradicting that point. We're saying, like, if you have money, you're going to be able to get on this. So the people who are able to get the most money, get the most money from many different people will be able to.
I disagree with that, Chris. I think that because they spread the idea behind it is they're asking you to demonstrate that you have a cross section of very small donors.
65,000. That's a lot.
That's a lot. But, you know, you can, you know, the stories about how easy it was for Senator Sanders to do it. They saw how easy it was for Mayor Pete to do it. So in other words, it can be done. And you're demonstrating that I'm not getting it from big pharma. I'm not getting it from the tobacco industry. I'm not getting it from the trial lawyers. I'm getting it from a cross-section of people, 200 of them in how many states? 20 states?
20 different states, yeah.
I think that they're actually making a concerted effort to have these candidates demonstrate that the source of their funding is closer to grassroots. I don't want to go crazy and call it grassroots, but closer to grassroots than you're typically seeing with, you know, the amount of money involved in politics. So I endorse that. But, you know, when you're having – the end of the day is, you know, the first debate is going to be a two-night event, you know, because
nights,
there's just not enough – you know, there's not enough space in our brains to look at 20 people on a stage and come out with it with any sort of, you know, education about what we just saw. And I'm not too sure you can do it with 10.
Do you think the average American – and, you know, I think all of us around the table are average Americans, or maybe we're slightly more interested in this than the average American. Do you think the average American is going to be willing to tune in to two nights in a row of debates with people on the stage that the most of whom they just haven't even heard of? Or is this thing just a total waste of time? Like, you know, what do you think about this part of the process?
I think that a lot of people will, like, you know, I think most people will. Most people that would watch it or that have watched it in past years would watch it. But at the same time, like we were talking about, just completely lost my train of thought.
No, that's okay. I mean, I think I think you brought up an important point that, you know, the Republicans did this in 2016. They had two night debates early on, but they did it a little bit differently. They said that if you're in the top 10 in the polls, right, and we can, if we had time, we can talk about whether we think polls are a great way to measure things. But they said if you're in the top 10, you'll be in the first night, and then if you're in the bottom, you know, in the first few debates, there were 20. So there was a bottom 10. They kind of called it the undercard debate.
Or they called it the kiddie table.
The kiddie table.
They called it the kiddie table.
And a bunch of the Republicans were like, you know, this is not a great way of doing it because nobody pays. It immediately moves people out of the limelight and kind of disqualifies them, you know. You know, it's almost like the early part of the process is so important to get that middle spot in the debate stage, and that's where Donald Trump was, right in the middle spot of the first debate stage, that, you know, the way the parties have structured this is in some ways dictating what the potential outcome could be. Go ahead.
I would say I absolutely agree with that. Like, the way that the structure is currently, it makes it very hard for people who don't have, like, pre-existing political influence to become involved in these debates and, like, the presidential election. Like, for someone who's a lot lesser known on a political scale, it is, like, I would say it's a lot more difficult now than it has been in previous times in American history for them to earn a spot on the debate stage.
I mean, let's just look at some of the names, right? You're talking about people who aren't as political. And, you know, I'm looking at a list of the names of the Democratic candidates, and I think at least half of them I'm kind of only vaguely familiar with. Do they have a fighting chance? And, you know, if they do have a fighting chance, I guess one of the questions I think we could touch on a little bit, what are the issues that are going to get them attention? You know, each candidate that's out there in the 2020 race, and all of this is, of course, we're kind of predicating our discussion on the assumption that Donald Trump will win the nomination of the Republican Party, which I think is a safe bet, but not a sure bet. It's not 100%, but it's pretty high. You know, are there any issues in particular that certain candidates that are in the Democratic field you think could play up and make their issue and own their issue? There's 23 candidates. This is my thing, and this is what's going to differentiate me from the field, and it's going to be what makes me competitive against the incumbent. Are there any issues that come to mind for any specific candidates?
You know, I think right now climate change is a big one, because I think when there was rumors that Joe Biden was going to play the middle ground on climate change, that kind of blew up, because I know the Democratic Party right now, they're trying to push out new legislation.
The Green New Deal, you're referring to?
The Green New Deal, yeah.
Well, they're all going to have to take positions on that.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's something that they have to answer, because it's such a pressing problem nowadays.
I think it's going to be interesting watching the debates and seeing the candidates try to separate themselves, especially with so many on there. Because, like, you're teachers, you've seen, like, especially student-run conversations. Mm-hmm. When there's so many kids, there's only so much time to speak.
Yeah.
And people get frustrated when they have an idea and they're trying to get it out, but they can't. I'm kind of interested to see, like, how that will affect the debate.
If you've got 40 seconds total out of an hour that you're going to really have the attention, you know, because let's be honest, you know, the first 15 minutes is when people are going to be watching and listening. That's when I want to say what I want to say. The issues they choose to talk about, no matter what question they're asked, they're going to talk about what they want to talk about. And that's the issues that they choose is going to be very fascinating.
A point you made earlier, Mr. Kellett, was the idea that where you stand might, if you're in the middle, it might positively impact the outcome. The press is going to positively impact the outcome. You know, because you're going to have those debates in which, you know, you will hear, whether it be Pete Williams or whoever it is say, you know, Senator Sanders, 60 seconds on this. And then he'll say, Senator Warren, your rebuttal. Senator Sanders, a rebuttal to that. And then 5 minutes later, you'll say, okay, you know, Governor Inslee, in 15 seconds.
And everyone will be like, who's that?
Exactly. Yeah. And it's going to be the narrative. That's going to be the narrative of, you know, you could make the argument that, you know, NBC and MSNBC and Telemundo are running these early debates. And there's a great deal of power that those networks have in shaping who is going to emerge, because whoever the water cooler conversation about who dominated that night's debate is going to probably lead to what Chris was talking about, those donors coming out of the woodwork, maybe, you know, funneling money in a certain way based upon how much sheer time on stage those people got. And it's largely predicated on what the networks decide to do for how they jazz up the stage for those two nights.
You know, I think it almost should be harder to get Megan on the debate stage, because it's not that difficult if you have that national presence to get small donations across the country. And I think that if you're someone who's throwing their hat in the ring and you don't have that national presence, it's almost, I wouldn't say it's a waste of time, but it can be, but you realistically know that you probably won't win the election.
Well, and that's one of the questions we were going to think about is, do you think that, and this is for everybody, do you think that all these people running for the Democratic nomination actually think they have a chance to win this thing? And if not, who do you think is in this not to win it? If I could put any of you on the spot.
I genuinely think that most of the candidates can have a chance to win right now. I don't think there's anyone that's really out of the race. It's, you know, the top four candidates only have less than, I think, 50% of the votes. So it's like, it's almost anyone's game right now. I would say that there's for sure some people that are probably pretty pessimistic about it and are looking at it like, we don't have a great chance. But I would say that there's probably, you know, very few candidates that would call themselves out of it yet.
Yeah, that's I think a lot of the candidates might share that hope with you that they have a chance. You're just looking over the list of names right now, Mr. Barry, and you're trying to pick somebody who you think doesn't have a chance. Go ahead. They're probably not listening.
Mayor Wayne Messam. Do you think Wayne Messam is already polishing up his inaugural address?
Well, you know, you say that, but then there's someone like Pete Buttigieg, who a lot of people would have put in the category of somebody who's just, you know, kind of a name nobody's heard of, but all of a sudden he got a lot of traction. Maybe these other candidates are just waiting for their moment. Is that a possibility?
Well, what this could also be a lot of these candidates could be doing is saying, like, I want some attention, and I'm in a position where I might not get that. I want to be able to advance my political career, and I'm using this campaign as a starting point. I don't know if it could negatively impact their future career or positively impact it.
Right. But,
right. I mean, even if you pretty much have absolutely no chance to win, you're still set to gain a lot from putting yourself out there and gaining support of people that, you know, might not have heard of you before. And I definitely do think, like, the presidential campaign is a great medium to do that, like a great medium to, like, expand your impact to horizons that you never would have seen if you didn't take that decision.
And candidates like Buttigieg, who are kind of, you know, on the outskirts of, you know, just politics, people really didn't know about them. You know, Buttigieg from Pence's home state, you know, first of all, you know, completely polarizing, so different. But Buttigieg, no one knew who he was. And then, you know, he gained traction, you know, him being gay, him being the mayor, and everyone loving him there in Indiana, which I think in 2016 was a red state. And so that's...
Yeah, it's traditional. He is a red state.
So that was different. But, you know, he was just kind of so with his, you know, he's gay, but he also has these really strong religious values, which is kind of an interesting dichotomy. But do you think that gave him like a really great edge, just him being the way he is?
Yeah. And I think that shows in this day and age how important media is, because if you don't get the media coverage, then people don't get to know, okay, what are your policy stances, who are you, and exactly, you know, what you stand for in this election. Because I think that's what's going to differentiate, because we have so many candidates, I think it's easier for people to find, okay, this person mostly aligns with my political views, this is who I'm going to support.
Right.
Now, does this also raises the question, like, with this many candidates in the last 2 years, is there going to be a precedent where more people use the presidential race as a medium to be noticed?
Well, I think that is kind of, you know, hitting at the heart of this. You know, when Donald Trump announced his campaign, many, if not most, people who follow politics thought that it was primarily being done as a way to develop his brand, as a way to get some attention, some publicity. But those opinions quickly changed. And I think that the nature of presidential races may be changed, you know, dramatically because of what Donald Trump has accomplished. I also think it's fair to speculate whether Donald Trump would have been as successful in 2016 had he not had such a large field dividing the vote, as some of you have kind of talked about. And I think if we look down the line at the 2020 race and we see a lot of people getting in for different reasons, some people struggling to find their issue, you know, I wonder how this will play out as in a way that's maybe similar to 2016, in which the party will quickly quickly kind of solidify their support around somebody, and then that person will gain momentum and, you know, kind of put this thing away. Or, you know, there's already some people out there talking about, you know, if there's any modern election that's likely to go to a brokered convention, it could be this one. You know, time will tell, but I think that it's worth talking about now and thinking about now what the nature of a large field does to a race. And if we're thinking about that, then we can maybe avoid the, well, I'm just going to, you know, do my cereal aisle, I'll go to what's known, I won't pay attention, maybe, you know. I think Democrats and Republicans alike in 2016 and 2020 have to reflect on whether or not this is the best way to do it. I think time will tell and the history books will tell.
Do you think that, you know, kind of everyone fighting for this attention will lead to kind of like almost a fast and loose Trump strategy where everyone's fighting for attention and maybe you just have to say something outrageous to get attention? I think that there's a real possibility that candidates might start making claims and promises that don't necessarily even reflect their own values, that aren't true, and just to get media attention.
Robert, I think I support a different theory where, you know, because you were in a race where there are so many people and not many people are familiar with you, I feel like if you were to put your platform and really really refine your platform and refine your image to a more simple thing that people can familiarize themselves with faster, I believe that would be a faster way to gain traction than just throwing yourself out there with like ridiculous claims.
I'm excited to see what the Republicans do with their primary race this year, because I don't think any Republicans besides Donald Trump have announced a bid.
Weld,
former Governor Weld,
but he hasn't gotten a lot of attention. You know, there might be some surprises, but I think it really depends on what the next year looks like for the administration of Donald Trump, to be honest.
Sure.
It all comes around to this concept of, you know, as teachers, we're supposed to talk about, you know, strengthening democracy. But I think we're going to be learning a lesson this time around that there's an awful lot of people, you know, who are suggesting that, and maybe they tend to overdramatize, but they're suggesting that this is a special election. And this is not the election to glorify 20-plus candidates in a flowering of democracy. If they get a sense that the waters are getting muddied and the electorate is getting confused and it gets to a point where the people who believe that they should get the job start slinging mud at each other and we start eating our young in certain, you know, aspects of one party, you're going to have a lot of people suggesting that an adult in the room, whether it's Bill Clinton, whether it's Barack Obama, whether it's some sort of heavy hitter in the Democratic Party, is going to sit down with these people, you know, and you've seen this in the past. You know, Mitt Romney at one point, it brought everybody to his place in Utah and had a conversation. Where is this the time to talk about the flowering of democracy, or is this the time to strategize, put our loving arms around one of these candidates and saying, this is our candidate? And be interested to see us having this conversation, what, you know, a year from now, you know, about where this is going. An awful lot of – it'd be very interesting to play this back, this conversation back a year from now when we're talking about how things are going after, you know, the Super Tuesday, which is very early this year. I believe it's like the first couple of days of March, like what, like almost 20 states, including California, going on one day. You know, how much of the 2020 election is going to be about what pride we can take in democracy versus what lesson we learned in practical politics?
Well, I think that that's probably a good place for us to start to wrap up, because I think you've reminded us at the table and anyone else listening just how long we have to go. And we're not going to know the answers to these questions yet, but we will have more of an idea as time goes on. We'll continue to talk about it as time goes on. You guys have any other closing thoughts, or maybe even, if you want, a bold prediction about which Democrat you think is going to come out of this thing? You know, I'll leave it there. If a closing thought, and if you can't think of one, who do you think, which Democrat you think is gonna win this thing? And maybe we'll play that back in a year and a half and see.
I think the politicians who have thrown their hat in the ring, they understand that the game is totally different now, because there's one big question out there, and it's, will young people vote in this election? Because if they do, then that really does change the tides and the trends. But there are a couple candidates that I want to win.
That's not what the question was.
Yeah, I know. But realistically, I think Joe Biden will win this, because he's been vice president. He's had the experience. And I think he's able to wrap up the independent voters.
Right. What else we got?
Well, with Joe, like, I also think Joe Biden has a very high chance of pulling ahead in this race. The only thing I could see pulling him back is how old he is. And we're, like, a lot of people, there's a kind of a growing consensus around the country that we want a fresher face. And I think that could hurt his chances.
Sure.
I think I would put all my chips in the middle on Senator Sanders. His platform kind of supports something that could be revolutionary to the average American in like almost a similar way that Trump's tax plan proposed more money in the pockets of the average American. I believe Senator Sanders' platform supports almost a very similar thing.
Well, I'd say regardless that for me, at least, unless some other candidate, I don't know if I can put my finger on one, but unless, you know, one of the top, you know, four or five is knocked down by someone else who makes a big claim or proposes a big, you know, bill or something, I think that it's going to be someone that we predict. I can't foresee, unless something radical happens, a really fringe candidate coming out of the woodwork.
Sure. Sure. I mean, those are probably the safest bets if you had to bet. But politics has surprised before, and Well, we'll just have to wait and see.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Mr. Kellett, what's your prediction?
Are teachers allowed to say that?
Well, yeah,
it's a podcast.
Prediction. You know, I think it's going to be hard for somebody to brand themselves in a way that they need to become as known as someone like Joe Biden in such a crowded field. So I think it's not a very interesting answer, but
it was a good pivot.
It was.
Thank you. What about you, Mr. Berry?
There's a room someplace, and it's very powerful people in that room, and they're doing electoral math, and they're choosing the states that matter more than other states. We probably talked about that before. We're going to talk about it again. If you're reading the tea leaves right now, a lot of people are suggesting that Hillary Clinton could have been president of the United States had she done a little bit more campaigning in certain Midwestern states.
You're not answering the question.
Here's
Mr.
my
Barrett.
Answer. Okay. I believe that, to sort of pile on, I think that the Democratic Party probably thinks that Joe Biden is the guy that can deliver those states. And I think if I'm Senator Harris right now, I think she is going to spend some time in the White House as well as vice president.
This is the second podcast in a row that you've mentioned a Biden-Harris combination. So
well,
you're
if
going
you think
out
that in this particular round, that if you think the Democratic Party is going to nominate as a ticket two white men, you're out of your mind. But at the same time, if you think that they're going to be a little bit more drastic, I think that's a little bit crazy too. I think Joe Biden might be the sober hand on the ship of state. And I think that someone like Senator Harris, you know, she's from California. She's a prosecutor. She's a district attorney. She's African American. She is brilliant, and she's well spoken, and she's got some money. I think that she has an awful lot to offer.
All right. Well, we'll have to wait and see. All right, and I'm sure predictions will change. It'll be a fun ride. I want to thank you all for participating. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
All right. And we'll keep the conversation going.